Well, good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I'd just like to say some thank yous. Thank you very much to Greenbelt for inviting me here. I'm probably a little bit different from some of the other people on the schedule because I'm not the kind of author who you'll find necessarily in a sort of Christian bookshop. I work in the mainstream of publishing. So it's really great to come to a festival like this, a festival which includes faith, because that is less apparent out there in the sort of main festival world beyond Greenbelt. And also thank you very much to Nigel and the Children's Society who had the idea to bring me along. Now, I gave this title, which you've seen on your programme. It's Into the Lion's Den or Through the Wardrobe Door, A Christian Writer's Adventures in Present-Day Publishing. So I wanted to start with a question about books. What was the first book that got you hooked on reading fiction? For some of you, that may be going back quite some way into the past, and some of you, it's only 15 years ago, 10 years ago. But I'm hoping little brain light bulbs are going off around the room as dusty corners of your memory are lit up with happy recollections. For me, that book was probably The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Anybody else share that? Yeah? Certain generation of us, isn't it? And I'd like you now to picture the hot summer of 1976. England was drying out under a hot sun. There were plagues of ladybirds descending in rather jolly biblical proportions. Sharing baths was no longer only something suggested by the spice up your love life pages on Cosmopolitan, but it was government policy. And in a garden in suburban Essex, a seven-year-old girl was looking through the lattice of the fence into her neighbour's garden. On the other side of that fence was that most exciting of creatures, a teenager called Gillian. And through the fretwork of red blossoms of what my father told me was the Japonica bush, Gillian was telling the little girl about this amazing story that had magic wardrobes, white witches, and talking lions. And then she handed over the book. And so that little girl escaped from the heat wave that summer into a land where it was always winter. And I don't think she has come back. Now, scroll forward a few decades, and that same little girl at the fence writes for children and young adults. Over what is quite an embarrassingly short period of time, 8 years, I have written some 30 novels published under 3 different pen names. And if you want to know about the other names, please, we can talk about that at questions. My books range across genres. They're fantasy, they're historical, they're thrillers. And you won't find them shelved in your local Christian bookshop. So by that very rough definition, I don't come under the Christian author sort of, you know, idea. But that doesn't stop my faith informing my worldview. It is, in fact, the very warp and weft of my imagination. Yet, to be frank, in the early days, I found having a faith a problem for my aspiration to write. I was in that, I'd just been converted, you know, I just sort of found faith and was in that fiery stage where you're kind of quite black and white about things. So I sort of said to myself, well, I've got this amazing good news, a loving creator God and a universe of marvels. How does that work with writing? And here are just some of the thoughts I had from then onwards. You may find some of them ridiculous, but they were all real at some point to me. So the first question was, where does the balance lie in writing between showing reality, our often immoral behaviour, and Christian moral standards, particularly when dodgy behaviour is exhibited by a sympathetic character? I mean, it's easy when it's a villain, but when it's somebody you're rooting for. A simpler question. Would a Christian write about witches? This was for a comedy picture book character I thought of but never wrote. Another question. What about sex, particularly the age, you know, the underage sexual relationship issue, which when you're writing for teens is out there as a real thing? And then you can tell where I was in my life at the time. Do I have responsibility to spread the good news to my readers? And then what about Jesus, the elephant in the room that nobody mentions in publishing anymore? Because every story would become his if I went down that road. Now, some of these questions now strike me as kind of being obviously immature, and I'm tempted to say, duh, yes, sarcastically to my previous self about some of those things, like witches. I have found answers to all of these, more or less. But there was really a kind of bigger problem that I was grappling with, which is about creativity and faith. How do the two come together? But the big realization I had was if I thought of myself as a Christian writer, I was like a person trying to sweep a room by holding a brush by the bristles. I needed to turn it around the other way and become a writer who is a Christian. I can leave the apologetics to people who do it much better than me and who are qualified for that job. So how do I come to this sort of obvious conclusion? Well, the midwives at the birth of this were C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. I now live in Oxford, where both of these writers lived, so I find that very inspiring, being in their city. But before Oxford, I had the good fortune to study with Nigel for my first degree in English at Cambridge, and I spent a term of my last year thinking about their writing and their faith. This time aside allowed me to establish an intellectual framework to turn the broom, and this is what I wanted to share with you now. Let's start with the basics. What does it mean to be an author? Well, according to the wonderful stories at the beginning of the Bible, we are made in the image of God. And the very first attribute demonstrated by that God, and this is the one I doubt least when other stuff begins to slide, is that he is creative. So that makes us creative beings. I'd go further. It's really an essential part how we find our meaning as human beings is by making things. It's our responsibility in our lives to cultivate our garden, our creativity. A fellow writer from Oxford said this: after nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the thing we need most in the world. Now, that's Philip Pullman. I disagree with him in some areas, but I'm definitely on his side about this. Don't you think that our grasp of our life's experience is so often arranged as a story? It's how we remember our past. And I've just shown you that by doing that Japonica bush idea. We aren't really plugged into our life's experience unless we have a story to help us channel that experience. And so there's a little aside here for everybody here. What was the last creative project you completed? Looking around the room, there may well be artists or musicians or something out there. But have you tapped into those days? Do you remember when you had paper and powder paints as a child? Or a junk model that your parents praised to the skies? You might keep in touch with that side. You might make clothes, plant flower beds, draw, paint, compose music. But perhaps you've left that behind. Maybe you're buried under emails and washing up, performance reviews and passive television watching. So at this point, I'm going to give you all a take-home mission. Why don't you try creating something this week? It could be a doodle, a poem, a short story, a flower arrangement. You might be doing something on your allotment, I don't know. But remind yourself this week that you are a creative soul. You don't need to have that stamp of approval from a publisher or a gallery to say that your production is good enough, because all creativity is valuable. Maya Angelou, the great American writer who died just a few months ago, said, "You can't use up creativity. The more you use, the more you have." So why don't you go and see if she's right? Anyway, back to my two midwives. I hope you have some familiarity with their fiction. Few children passed through primary school when I was growing up without also stepping through the wardrobe. That's still largely true today, though often the medium that they see this story is film rather than a book. C.S. Lewis had a marvellously fertile imagination, which he knew was due to his faith. He wrote, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." So when he got down to the business of writing his Narnia stories for children, he could not help but tell the story of Jesus. For him, it was the only story, the one he saw everywhere and in everything. Looking back, I'd say that his retelling definitely prepared the soil for my own understanding of what a relationship with Jesus might be like, and I'd be ever grateful to him for that. But, rather perversely, I found his methodology really unhelpful to me as a writer. You see, he'd kind of done it. He'd created Aslan, Jesus as a lion, and managed to contain him convincingly within his story world. And then he expanded out from there and tackled creation in The Magician's Nephew and revelation in The Last Battle. So he'd covered Alpha and Omega. So what was left for the rest of us? And yet, for all the brilliance of that series, looking at them from a writer's viewpoint, I would say there's something, this is if I'm going to start criticising him so you can hiss if you like, half digested about some aspects of Narnia. It's particularly clear in Prince Caspian, with Greek mythological creatures popping up all over the place, including Silenus, without a clear explanation of what they're doing there and why they belong. It bothered me as a child, so this is going way back, partly because I didn't have the classical reference points. I went to a kind of county primary school, not a private school. And I think Lewis was writing in the 50s, wasn't he? So he could assume that his children would have an awareness of the classical world. But also, they're not really an organic part of the fantasy. I think the same could be true of Father Christmas popping up in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but we can talk about that later. I still find them weak threads, to be honest. But on the other hand, I don't think C.S. Lewis would care two hoots for me and this criticism, because he said, "Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth, not caring tuppence how often it's been told before, you will, 9 times out of 10, become original without ever having noticed it." In this quote, Lewis is raising that question that Pilate puts to Jesus. What is truth? Lewis thought he had the answer, so he set out on a mission to describe it. So I suppose I can forgive him for low levels of collateral damage of random Greek gods in a Narnian landscape. But that's not really where he's usually criticised, is it? Certainly today, there's a body of writers led by Philip Pullman who dislike him intensely for having a didactic religious purpose. Pullman said, "I find them," by which he means the Narnia stories, "very dodgy and unpleasant. Dodgy in the dishonest rhetoric way, and unpleasant because they seem to embody a worldview that takes for granted things like racism, misogyny, and a profound cultural conservatism that is utterly unexamined." Yet I think what he's failing to allow here is that Lewis was of his time, and his approach fitted that publishing world. That kind of criticism of him is unfair. It's like telling P.G. Woodhouse not to be such a snob, or Jane Austen, "You must include more sex scenes." I guess it'd be almost impossible to get The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe published in the mainstream today, certainly in this country. Tolerance of wider faith, you know, sort of faith and no faith, has had the result of narrowing options for the writer, who is also a Christian. I'm sure some editors are afraid of those with openly religious views and afraid of offending the wider public. They don't want to be accused of proselytising children by the back door. Not that it stops them sending out all sorts of other messages, of course. I'm sure there are exceptions to this rule and ways of handling faith that are acceptable. But I do find myself censoring, weighing up the reception of what I want to write in an imagined classroom or library context. And I'm fine with that. I have a responsibility not to break the author-reader contract by publishing a personal agenda to which they've not agreed. If I'm asked a direct question about faith, I answer honestly, otherwise it's more or less off the menu. Though having said that, even when the Narnia stories were first written, his friend Tolkien was sniffy about Narnia and made pointed comments about his dislike of allegory in stories, and allegory is part of what C.S. Lewis is about. I think Tolkien would have felt his friend failed to keep his touch light. His tone of annoyance is quite plain in his own preface to Lord of the Rings. He says, "I cordially dislike allegory in all its manifestations and always have done so since I grew old and wary enough to detect its presence. I much prefer history, true or feigned, and its varied applicability to the thought and experience of readers." I think that many confuse applicability with allegory, but the one resides in the freedom of the reader and the other is the purpose domination of the author. Quite a lot of content in that quote, but it's a wonderfully rich statement if you move sideways and think about the, let's say, the parables of Jesus. "He who has ears, let him hear and apply." There are times in the Narnia stories where Lewis goes full out for kind of telling, doesn't he? Such as the end of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. You don't have to dislike it. It could be argued that for a young readership, it's about time he gave some straight answers to the question, how does this all work in my world? Where is Aslan for me? But others might find it collapses the fantasy, like pulling out a pole in the middle of a tent. And I think I've held both views at different times, but as an author, you don't need to be consistent. Okay, let's put aside this little spat about allegory between Tolkien and Lewis and turn more directly to Tolkien himself. Lewis nailed his colours to the mast as a Christian during his lifetime with radio talks and books, as you well know. Tolkien inhabited his identity as Roman Catholic in a less public way, but it's there to be seen if you think about his strategies. And these are the ones which I actually find most helpful in terms of my own writing craft. First, Tolkien was a sub-creator extraordinaire. I think Lewis's world, and almost every fantasy world you can think of, looks a shallow pond to Tolkien's Middle-earth ocean. He took it to bizarre extremes, devising languages, maps, elaborate histories. And it took him far more than 6 days, well over 50 years, of scholarship and creativity. I'm very much drawn to this complete imaginative world, as so many other people are, though I don't personally have the patience to replicate this achievement in the obsessive detail. But there's something godlike about it, isn't there? In a way, I think all of us authors do this. We sit as gods ruling the destinies of our characters. I personally particularly enjoy thinking up new cultures. I wrote a fantasy novel called Dragonfly, where I had loads of fun devising a matriarchal society from which my heroine comes. I wanted to see what it would be like to have a world that was ruled by women. And I'll just read you a little extract, a very short extract from the beginning of the book. This is aimed at a kind of young adult readership. "The fourth crown princess of the Blue Crescent Islands had 16 rituals to observe from the moment of waking to when she broke her fast. These included getting out of bed on the right-hand side, turning to the east to bow to the sun, submitting to having her hair groomed with 40 strokes from a silver-backed brush by the under-mistress of the royal chamber, and..." Princess Tawashira paused. "What have I forgotten? Goddess, rot the etiquette mistress's rulebook. I know there's something else." "Your finger bowl, your highness," intoned the senior mistress of the chamber, holding out a bronze basin. "Finger bowl. Why do I always forget the finger bowl?" Tawashira rinsed her fingertips delicately and dried them on a white linen towel. And it goes on from there, and you see that she is part of a society which has a goddess figure, four different aspects of the goddess. That's why everything is in fours. So what am I doing, devising a whole new theology? Well, I positioned it in my mind as a society in that world's equivalent of an Old Testament period. This meant I had the wonderful chance to have a main character who is intensely religious. one of her most important journeys in the book is a spiritual one. She loses her faith almost, and it's the hero who helps her rediscover it. They're going to mention a character here called Fergox Spearthrower, who is like the big evil guy in the book. I can't explain it, Ram. I think I've lost my beliefs completely. My faith was like one of those bogs out there. I thought it was all green and pleasant until I tried trusting myself to it. Then I fell through. Tashi clutched her hands together in a tense, desperate knot. I'm drowning. Rammel ran his fingers through his hair in exasperation. Look, I don't know very much about your faith, but if it's anything like mine, I'd be wondering if the Supreme Being can't use even a man like Fergox in his or her plans. You might be where you are now because your goddess exploited the spear thrower's greed. Maybe she wants you here. Tashi opened her eyes. His dark gaze was fixed on her, full of compassion. Do you think that's true? She whispered, hardly daring to allow herself to hope. Oh, Tashi, I don't know. Rammel rubbed his face, not feeling up to this deep discussion, though he knew it was vital. I've never claimed to know what's true when it comes to the big questions of religion. What I do know, Tashi, is that it's possible and preferable to the alternative explanation that Fergox is in control of all our destinies. And I suppose the only way to find out who is right is to live our lives as if we do have faith in our father, or mother in your case. It seems to me that in the end, your goddess and my god are two sides of the same creator. I suppose what I wanted to do here, it is a book about battles and slavery and all sorts of other stuff, but in that quieter moment, wanted to show that a spiritual life, its trials and joys, is as exciting as a physical battle or a romance. Our experience of faith contains aspects of both, doesn't it? God woos our soul, it's a kind of romance. We fight both him and the world's temptations, that's the battle. So faith is an adventure in its own right. And there's a funny little thing about Dragonfly, which was published in the States, and it won a prize in Utah. So I reckon something about that talk of faith must have appealed to the very large Mormon community out there. But that just goes to show you can never tell how your books are going to work out when they're out in the world. I think writing is also fascinating, and it teaches you something about God's relationship to free will. I've mentioned the godlike role of the writer in creating an imaginary world. Once I've set up my characters, you imagine them enough, they do not always behave. They run off with their own destinies because they have to be them. I have a particular moment in mind when I discovered this. I've written about a girl called Kat Royal. She is a sort of streetwise redhead living in the 18th century Drury Lane Theatre. And she went off the rails in that way. I had her in a room with an enemy. He's a slave owner. And she refused to behave. It was a posh gentleman's club and she was handing over some theatre tickets. And it all went horribly wrong. Leaving my plot behind, she lost her temper and did her own thing. Once she'd trashed the gentleman's club, I had to send her on the run to avoid reprisals, and that went off in a completely unexpected and rich direction. If I had tidied things up as per my original plot plan, I would have pruned my character out of shape. And I've wondered since is whether or not this is how, in a sense, how God sees us, that he's not going to prune us out of shape. Our free will exists in fulfilling our character. Having taken you to these godlike heights, I want to return us to Tolkien, because there's another aspect showed in his writing which people out here who are aspiring to write might find interesting. It certainly helped me as an author. He does tell a Christian story, but the structure is buried deep. It's kind of like the coding. In The Lord of the Rings, there are loads of ways you can read it. And I'm not the first person to say that the character of Gandalf with his death, resurrection and his sort of salvation is like a mini version of Christ. Tolkien didn't give him the stature of a Christ figure, sort of a step down from that, isn't he? And he doesn't save everyone all the time. But there's clear drawing on the logic of the Christian story. I see it as a kind of basic programming, like the kind of thing you have underlying CGI creations that you see in films. Have you ever looked at a making of video from something like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings cycle? He shows you how they create Gollum, and it's all numbers and skeletons underneath, which they then put on layers of designs. So you've got to think of the Christian story as being like the skeleton on which the later layers of design are fixed. But it's important to see that it's not a closed interpretation. You know, Tolkien didn't want us to do an allegory, because that would be the kind of thing he hated. Like our own skeletons, we all look pretty similar, I imagine. If we were sitting here without our flesh and blood, we wouldn't be able to tell us apart. But then there are many, many different ways that flesh can be applied, so that's the application. You can read it purely as story and not worry about any other meanings. You can think about it as being Tolkien's thinking about the Norse sense of Ragnarok, which is the idea we're all heading for a great defeat. There's a melancholy that hangs over Lord of the Rings. But there's also an instinctive understanding of the writer that the Christian story works. It's a tale underlying not only the Bible, but the pattern is replicated endlessly elsewhere, possibly in all cultures at all times. It has an emotional intelligence and a fundamental truth, so it does not tire with retelling. I like this openness. I much prefer my reader to ponder. I've never been a fan of those signs outside churches. I don't know what your church does, but we've just been away in Mexico, and I saw quite a few churches with the equivalent of repent or be damned outside. I only like the ones that have humour. My favourite being God loves spiritual fruits, not religious nuts. But otherwise, I fear they do more harm than good, as if we're communicating with those around us by megaphone. I prefer to think that God speaks to us sort of intimately through stories and songs that also lay outside, you know, strict religious revelation. I kind of attempt to do this a bit in my own books. I don't think I'm overstating it here. I try. In The Minds of the Minotaur, which is the third in a fantasy story about the secret society for the protection of mythical creatures, and that's a kind of Greenpeace with dragons, there are two creatures, a minotaur and a dwarf, who are having a discussion about the ultimate meaning of things in the presence of the heroine, who's called Connie. The minotaur has the view that life is full of pain and grief, short, bitter lives and desperate ends. And he asks, where is your creator in all of this? And the dwarf, by contrast, believes we're a part of a greater design, something that is more the sum of atoms that make up our being. Each life has value and meaning, even the briefest. And he also adds, we are all stardust. I like the approach to have the big questions in a book as a kind of debate, because it would be arrogant to think I had the answer down pat. In my latest fantasy series, Young Knights, it's kind of suitable for kids in years 5, 6, 7, and 8 at school, that kind of age group. I'm doing Arthurian tales in a contemporary setting. And I was trying to think, well, where they're in our world, so where does God fit? What's the religious perspective for imaginary creatures such as fairy folk, ogres, and trolls? So I have them referring to their creator as a sort of absentee landlord to whom they pay distant respect. And here the parables have been very useful as a way of handling this. This means that the bubble world of magic, the fiction, isn't popped by a collision with a different kind of narrative. So before leaving my two midwives, Lewis and Tolkien, I really enjoyed making the midwives, by the way, I think it might be worth recapping on the two points I've drawn from them. One is, don't forget your homework, is that we're creative beings. We're put on earth, sent off to be sub-creators. Now this gives great dignity to that side of your character that you may feel a little shy of. No longer is that novel in the drawer a frivolous waste of time. It's an expression of the fundamental nature of your humanity. Get it out, blow the dust off. But I suggest that you do that in the understanding that writing is your cake, and if it had any dreams of publishing, regard that as your icing, because you may have to settle for making a Madeira rather than a wedding cake, but you still achieve something worthwhile by writing. And the second thing is, you don't have to put your faith, Christianity, or if you have some other faith, don't have to put that up front. And you can still have that as part of your worldview. It can be the underlying code, the structure, the plot. It can feed your creativity, not hem it in. I had to go through that thinking process myself, but when I emerged from the other end, I of course discovered that loads of other people had got there first, always the way. The idea of a simple plot being common to human experience has been well written about elsewhere, but I do find this idea fascinating. If we are in some sense all telling the same stories, does that not say something about our shared humanity, and by the extension, the nature of God, if we are in his image? John, that most writerly of the gospel writers, had it sort of interlaced imagery running through his gospel, and he boldly states Jesus is the word right at the beginning, thought expressed, passed on, communication from God to us. So we should not be surprised to find that other words are used in this conversation between us and our Maker. What's this conversation about? You've probably heard lots of sermons, but in the sort of writerly world, there's one thing that keeps coming up, which is the seven basic plots. I enjoy going around schools and doing what writers' workshops, and I sometimes say, here's a single side of A4, this size. We are now going to make a note of every possible story in the world. Do you believe me that that's possible? Usually the kids will say no. But then we have a look at the seven basic plots. I use the Christopher Booker definitions if you know anything about his book. And he has these. The first basic story we all tell is overcoming the monster. Anybody want to give me an example of that? Not from Christian experience, but from world experience. Yeah. The Gruffalo. Yes, why not? You know, loads of stories fit into this. Most superhero movies do. What about rags to riches? Cinderella. Pride and Prejudice. Oliver Twist. See? The Journey Home. The Wizard of Oz. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. And, of course, probably one of the original ones is The Odyssey. He takes forever to get home. The Quest. Examples of The Quest. Yeah. King Arthur, he certainly has a quest for the Holy Grail. How about Bridget Jones' Diary? Her quest is for the man and to keep her weight down. Tragedy, well, I reckon this is where the writer's a bit cheating, but, you know, Hamlet, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Comedy, Aristophanes, Beano stories. But I like, most of all, transformation. Anybody got some transformation stories? Think fairy tales. Beauty and the Beast, yeah. Anyone want to shout out another one? Yeah. The Frog Prince, oh, that's a lovely story. The Ugly Duckling. And in kind of superhero world, Spider-Man. Any of those guys who become their superhero, that's what they're doing. So in the classroom, I will fit tales into this structure. But you can do the same with the Bible. Maybe if you're a bit bored at church one day, you can have a go. Because what is the overarching story? Well, there's one of transformation. The ugly duckling into a swan. Us into sons and daughters of God. It's also a journey home to our Creator. It's a quest for the truth. And this is the kind of truth I find in stories which some strands of Christianity would refer more to as a historical fact. So I don't have a literal belief in Adam and Eve, but I believe their story is true in that it describes us. Jonah and the Whale, brilliant comedy, plenty of slapstick moments, but it's also about changes of mind. A quest to go and preach to the people of Nineveh. You can see I often get bored in sermons, can't you? I'm sitting there doing all this. Anyway, Jesus was also a brilliant storyteller. You don't need me to tell you that. And I'm sure he knew we find it easy to remember plot structures when exhortations fades. I find it easier to remember the prodigal son rather than the Beatitudes. So the prodigal son, the journey home, Dives and Lazarus, rags to riches and riches to rags. And even in just those simple images he gives us, like the camel through the eye of the needle, our stories in miniature. This one is drawing on transformation, the beast changing from its usual stance to go on its knees through the smallest gateway in the city. Now, this is the kind of thing that gets me excited, because I feel there's a wonderful supply of God-inspired plots out there if I can plug myself into them and it can power what I write. And if you're listening from a secular or viewpoint, you would probably think of that as a kind of plots inspired by our shared DNA inheritance or something. I kind of think of it more to do with divine. Having said all that, there is a sense in which we are always going to fail as writers, because we are only sub-creators. We're sub. A book, even though I love my books dearly, they are not anywhere as wonderful as the miracle of a baby, a butterfly, or even a humble beetle. But I think that sense of not quite making it is what keeps us trying. Our lives are imperfect, not perfect. There's a writer called Theodore Dreiser who wrote for the early 20th century American market. He wrote, "Words are but the vague shadows of volumes we mean. Little audible links, they are, chaining together great inaudible feelings and purposes." That's why creativity costs, because we're all lost for words at some point. For most of us, it might be when we have to write a difficult condolence note or a difficult letter of apology. Authors have this experience all the time, because what we have inside can't quite get out. Henry David Thoreau, another American thinker, says this rather beautifully. "A perfectly healthy sentence is extremely rare. For the most part, we miss the hue and fragrance of thought, as if we could be satisfied with the dews of the morning or evening without their colours, or the heavens without their azure." Of course, the irony here is he's just expressed extremely well, in a perfect sentence, what he says he can't express, but that's why I like him. So we've got to keep on with our writing mission, and we sometimes succeed in taking the reader on the same journey that we are on. And the sort of final person I want to mention here is Emerson, because he has this lovely sentence. He says, "The maker of a sentence launches out into the infinite and builds a road into chaos and old night, and is followed by those who hear him with something of a wild, creative delight." What I like about this image is it suggests that the imagination you put in your books, it's the road, it's the causeway into darkness that your reader is walking along behind you. So once my books are published, they're no longer mine, they're yours. They become your creative playground. So finally, turning out to anyone out here who is an aspiring writer, I've already met some younger ones earlier in the day. If you dare to try and get into the mad world of publishing, you are both going through the wardrobe and into the lion's den. Good luck and God be with you. But let's face it, you wouldn't be a writer unless you were up for the adventure, would you? Okay, so now very happy to take questions. Do we have a roving mic?
We don't have a roving mic.
Okay, so if you have a question, put your hand up and shout, and I will repeat the question into the microphone here.
We can get a little bit close.
Oh, there's a question on the carpet there.
What other pen names do you have?
I kind of set myself up for that one. So these are my most recent Julia Golding books. As you can see, they are fantasy titles aimed at a kind of late primary, early secondary readership. So that's what's over in the bookshop. But when my daughter became a teenager, I decided to start writing for teens. And I have two names. One is Joss Sterling, which is contemporary thriller or romance, or romantic thriller, or some combination of that. And they're doing really well for me indeed. And the first one in that series is called Finding Sky. And they've gone into loads of different languages, so that's quite exciting. And then I have a pen name with Puffin or Penguin as Eve Edwards, and that's historical novels. Most recently is a older, it's kind of upper end of teen, so quite serious books about the First World War. And that's called Dusk, and the second part's called Dawn. The reason they're in different groups is because they have, well, first of all, there's appropriate material, so age-appropriate material. So Julia Golding, you don't have to worry, parents, they're all kind of fine for younger minds. Teen books are still fine, but they are dealing with older people with older concerns, and this readership doesn't necessarily cross over between those who read contemporary and those who like literary historical. So keeping the two names separate made it easier. That's the reason. Mixture of practical and... it's a bit like a brand, having a brand on each book. Any more questions? Yeah.
How far will we get?
Thank you. When can somebody first describe themselves as a writer?
I became a writer when I was about 7, because I seriously wrote stories. Shall we have a different category of the published writer? That's when the gate begins to narrow. But as I was saying, there is a real value to writing. You may find, I don't know if you're interested in writing or you already write, there is a real value to what you're doing. Partly because you're exploring that creative side of you, which I think is so vital. But also, you will be communicating with those around you. It doesn't matter how small your audience is. You have something to share with other people. I started writing, which led into my professional writing, to read bedtime stories. I found it was easier to write it down than make it up, because by the evening I was so shattered. I kind of wanted to have already done the thinking. So that's where my first book came from, was bedtime stories. That's writing for kids. But yeah, so if you write, you're already a writer. Any more questions? I'm wondering if someone's going to push me a bit more on the faith agenda, because I kind of soft-soaped that.
How many books have you written?
Okay, it's about 30. I'm very prolific. That's another reason for three names, because I compete against myself on the bookshelves. Got a really great, where I live, got a really great bookshop called Blackwell's. And they have a separate children's section and a separate teen section. And I get a bit of both, you see. At the back there. I think you might have to shout.
I don't think we're going to get that far.
Can you?
Sorry.
Oh, it might go.
We might have feedback issues as well, but hopefully it will be okay. Sorry if I hit anyone.
Have you ever been told by a publisher, oh no, you can't write that, that's not, that won't go down well with this group or that group? I'm asking because I was, when years and years ago after the war, I was living in Germany, was asked to write by Ernst Klass some books for German children, teenagers, to learn English from. And I submitted three types of plot. One was based, I remember, in Stonehenge, and I was told, you can't do that because the German children will associate it with the myths and Wagner, and Hitler liked Wagner, and you can't have anything associated with that. And then I suggested something else, and, oh, you can't do that because it'll look like British supremacy because we won the war and they lost it. And by the end, I said, oh, forget
what
it.
What can I do?
Can't
yeah.
be bothered.
I think everyone heard that question, which is an excellent question. Yes, sometimes it's been funny. Sometimes it's a sign of the times. So when I was writing a Tudor historical teen book as Eve Edwards, I got really interested in the perspective of a Roman Catholic priest who was, you know, they under Queen Elizabeth, they would smuggle themselves back in and do kind of secret masses and things for people. And this guy gets caught. He's a real historical figure, which I put in the book. And I had a sort of an interrogation scene with him. And I got really, really interested in why he was doing this. He became a really big character for me. And I gave it to my editor, and she said, this is all very interesting, but you do realise you're writing for teen girls, and let's cut back on this guy and have more of the young couple, you know. So there's sometimes, it wasn't really censorship, it was just the wrong book for that exploration to happen in. But one that you may find really funny, I haven't had your experience of like the German thing, but when I first started out, one series of books went into the American market. And the fourth book in this series has a big cataclysmic ending. It's called The Chimera's Curse. And against the big sort of battle going on, there is a baby being born. And the hero comes home. It's his stepmom. He's having a baby, and she's having it at home. By mistake, it's kind of come too soon. And it's supposed to be like a quiet counterpoint to something that's going on elsewhere. Not a huge part of the plot, but important. And this was published in the UK, absolutely fine. But then I get this worried email from America, thinking, oh, what's wrong here? And they said, well, we can't have an unattended birth. What do you mean? We need to have a medical practitioner present when this baby's born. So I had to, maybe I wouldn't do it now, but this was like early days. I had to change the sequencing so the doctor arrived a few pages earlier. I don't know what they thought. I mean, surely in America, babies get born in taxis and, you know. But anyway, I don't know what they thought I was advocating. It wasn't as if it's even sort of, it's slightly off stage. It's not the place to do a graphic, you know, description of birth. But anyway, so it was thought inappropriate in America to not have health insurance and be born out of a hospital circumstance. Oh, in America, kids' books are another funny thing. Friends of mine who do picture books, a friend did a sort of baby's bath time book, and in the sort of European market, the sweet little pictures of babies sitting in the bath, the waterline comes up to below their navel, so you can see the little dimple, and it has to be redrawn in the States, so the water up a bit higher. Sorry, I love them. I have great fun in America, and they're better on other things than us. But those two little things make me laugh. Any other questions?
Have you ever been told by a mainstream publisher that something you've written is kind of too overtly Christian? I mean, have you ever had a sort of... Because I'm trying to write a book at the moment where the main characters are Christian, and it's not. I'm not trying to be evangelical about it, but when I took it to an agent, she always thought I was going to be a raving evangelical when I, you know... And I just wonder whether you'd had any sort of experience.
Yeah, there's a lot of self-censorship that goes on. But it's easier once you're established. So it may not be the place to start. Sorry, this is a bit cynical, isn't it? Well, maybe I'm just being realistic. It's also, another way around it is historical. One of my Tudor books, it's a kind of other side of the track story. It's a Puritan girl and a young man who's in the theatre, and the Puritans regarded the theatre as the work of the devil at the time. So I could do quite an in-depth exploration of somebody's faith and crises of and learning about tolerance, and this set in Tudor England. So that's another way to go, because of course it's everybody's life experience then and is the main subject that people were worried about. So if you're interested in getting published, you might need to think of some strategies to make it work. I could probably get away with it more now because I've got a track record. Even so, it's also part of that contract. I don't just get read by, you know, people of faith, of Christian faith. I'm read a lot by all different backgrounds and no backgrounds, and I want them all to find something relevant. It's tricky. Yeah. Now, we're sort of heading towards the end of the time. I'm going to pop over to the signing tent immediately after. Actually, it's at 5, but between you and me, we could just go there now, unless there's no table free. If you want to buy books, the ones that they have are the Young Knight series. I'll just tell you about them in case you've got young people back home for whom this would be the right book. There are a three-part series. It'll be the kind of book that if your guys back home are reading Percy Jackson or Harry Potter, it's up their street. But it's a reimagining of Arthurian tales in today's world. The young people in the book have been grown up in the magical world of Avalon. So their normality is ogres and trolls and magic. And then they have to be sent back as secret agents and fit in a very large, comprehensive school. And, you know, obviously chaos ensues. So they're kind of funny, but they're also a quest. And there's a big mission in it. So these are the ones which they have over there. And also, if you didn't get a chance to ask your question, or you have a question which you prefer to talk to me directly about, because some of you may be writing and have a specific question, I'm also more than happy to answer that kind of thing too. So thank you very much for listening, and enjoy the rest of Greenbelt.
Thank you very much, Julia.